From Human Angle, this is The Crisis Room. I'm Salim.
And I'm Salma. Today on the show, Nigeria's lost children.
According to UNICEF, Nigeria has the highest number of out-of-school children in the world, an estimated 20 million. That's one in every 10 children globally.
Many of them roam the streets of towns and major cities without guardianship or structured education. And behind those numbers are cycles of neglect, forced labor, trafficking, and recruitment into armed groups.
It's a very quiet crisis, but one with consequences that could worsen insecurity, poverty, and instability for generations.
Today, we'll hear from experts and advocates on how Nigeria got here and what it will take to break the circle.
And to really understand what this looks like on the ground, we turn to someone who's been reporting directly from Kano, northwestern Nigeria. Human Angle journalist Aliu Dahir Aliu, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Salim.
You've been reporting extensively on this issue from Kano, one of the epicenters of Nigeria's out-of-school crisis. When you walk through the city, what do you see? Paint us a picture.
Okay, so when you walk through Kano City, you'll find a myriad of problems. First, you'll be seeing young children moving around with begging bowls, and then you'll also find young children hawking small goods like granite, pure water, or snacks because they are there to help their families. At the time when they're supposed to be in classes. But because Kano has kind of a system of education in which sometimes children go to school in the afternoon and sometimes they go in the morning, so you cannot see or you cannot differentiate between somebody who is going to school and somebody who doesn't go to school from just looking at the picture. But what you can confirm is that once you see a young boy moving around, begging for alms with a begging bowl, you know that one is an almajiri and is most likely not going to any formal school. If we mean going to school, it's like going to formal kind of school.
What are the main drivers? Is it poverty, corruption, or policy failure?
I can say it's kind of the mixture of all. Number one, the poverty, because some of the families need to weigh the opportunity cost. Once a boy comes from a poor family, he's expected to support the family from younger or tender age. And going to school means that he can't support the family. He can't work small goods or work for somebody to bring. That one is a big issue. And the main cause of that is poverty. So that one is one of the biggest issue. And then there is attitudinal problem as well. Like most of the children you see with begging bowls, like most of the almajiri, it's not because they come from a very poor family. It's because they have this cultural and the religious view that they need to go elsewhere away from their family and sit under a malam and have to beg in kind of a stoic kind of life before they can get a well-trained religious education. And that's why they are sent far away to anywhere under any malam for them to get Islamic education or Quranic education. So this is more about culture or religious kind of view than of poverty. And then another thing is about the policy. Why I don't always blame policy that so many policies have been tested and all of them fail because if there is no attitudinal change, there is no way policy can work. For example, in Kano, there are so many children. Many children have been born. Family planning is not very popular in northern Nigeria entirely. Because of that, every year, thousands of children are being born, if not hundreds of thousands have been born. And these children are growing up and they need to go to school. Without classes, without these schools, because the government cannot, you know, spend the entire budget on building new classes or building new schools. So these children will then have to be congested in one class. And that will mean some of the children will be going to schools without finding a very good seat and then without learning anything. And that will make their parent to question whether even going to the school is worth it. And then they will be sending them to hawking petty goods or something like that. So this is another thing with the policy. And even when they say that the education is free here, but the problem is that you need to be giving your kids some money to be buying food when they go to school, because there's no food in school. They could see that uniform is free, notebook is free. But what about textbooks? What about the food that the boy has to eat in the school? What about supporting the family if he comes from a very big and poor family? So this is a big issue.
If I'm to get you right, it's not just about children that are living in the city. There are also children that are being bought into the city in the name of al-majority, right? So we have two categories of out-of-school children, that is. So do you think curtailing that number, you know, stopping those numbers from coming into Kano would solve the problem, would be a start?
I think it can solve, but to some extent, not entirely. Because just stopping al-majority from coming into the city doesn't mean that's the end of it. There are parents, as I told you, that the main cause of, or the main reason why they are not sending their children to school is because of the poverty. So there are problems in the family and they need to support themselves and they need to send the child to hawk before they can eat. Yes. And that's another problem, but it can solve it to some extent. Most of the out-of-school children you can see in Kano, most of them are al-majority children, but I don't think stopping them will stop the problem entirely.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. So from your perspective on the ground, how does Nigeria's crisis compare to other countries that you have studied and reported on?
Okay, so the main difference between Nigeria and other countries in Africa is that in Nigeria, we have out-of-school children in millions, while in other countries, you cannot find such number. Because al-majority system of education is more prevalent in Nigeria than anywhere around the African continent. So even in Niger Republic, where we share some cultural and religious similarity, you cannot find the number of al-majority in such scale that we have in Nigeria. So Nigeria had these kind of two problems. Because we have a very big population that comes with a very big out-of-school children. So in Nigeria, the percentage, the number is so high than in any other African country.
What scale of out-of-school children are we talking about in Kano? Do we have a number and how does it compare to the national average?
We don't have the number. We can only estimate. So we are seeing the children. So as you know, since 2006, there was no population census in Nigeria.
Yes.
So we cannot know the number of anything. We can just estimate. So in Kano State, we have a large number of out-of-school children, but I can't tell you how many are there, and I cannot even estimate the percentage.
Okay.
Whatever we have is just, you know, assumptions and estimations and everything like that. But we don't have the real number at hand.
Aliyu's reporting gives us a picture of what's happening day to day. But what does it mean for Nigeria's future as a society? To answer that, we are joined by Dr. Labo, a lecturer at the Usman Nfodio University History Department. Dr. Labo, welcome and thank you for honoring us.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to participate in this podcast interview.
When millions of children are excluded from education, what does this do to a society over time? And how does this generational neglect affect poverty circles in Nigeria?
In Nigeria, for instance, Nigeria, given the several reports, had the highest number of out-of-school children. If you take the several reports we have been having, you see out-of-school children in Nigeria, the figure is put at between 10.5 and 13.5 million. And you see, excluding millions of children from education has long-term structural consequences because it creates a vast underclass of citizens without literacy, skills, or confidence to participate meaningfully in the economy or governance. So you see, over time, this undermines innovation, reduce productivity, and even weakens democratic participation. You see, in Nigeria, particularly northwestern Nigeria, because majority of the people in the region lack tools to hold their leaders accountable. And so it is clear Nigerian society, especially in the Northwest, becomes stratified with minority political elites or political class holding enormous opportunities because they are educated, while majority remain locked out. This leads to inequality and resentment. Eventually, this erode national stability because no society can sustainably progress when most of its human capital is under tap. Moreover, out of school children became potential recruits for armed groups, even though I know you must have questions about that. But I think what I am about to say, out of school children become potential recruits for armed groups. And it is evident, we have various studies that suggest violent actors are exploiting the vulnerability of out of school children, making them join their ranks. So I am sure, when majority of Nigerian people are out of school, Nigeria is missing a lot of opportunities for its growth and development in economy, politics, and what have you.
Thank you very much, sir. That was actually going to be part of my next question, which was talking about social cohesion. How does this affect social cohesion when a large segment of society is left behind, and you have so captured it well in your response?
Okay.
More of a follow-up on the responses that you have given so far. Do you think this is purely a policy failure? Is there a deeper cultural and societal attitude at play?
Yeah, I don't think this is purely a policy failure, but I can say it is both. Beyond this policy, there are cultural and societal attitudes that like normalize excluding of some children because in some communities, particularly in rural areas of northern Nigeria, you see early marriage, gender bias, and poverty, that lead to prioritization of child labor over and above schooling. If several children out of schools or out of class, because it's not always seen as, or education is not always seen as essential, especially when poverty forces families to value immediate survival over long-term gains. Thus, while policy reform is crucial, I think deep cultural reorientation is equally necessary to shift values towards prioritizing education as a non-negotiable right of children to be upheld by both parents and government.
I do agree. Thank you, sir. You have touched on how it's more of an intersectional issue. There's the policy failure, there's the culture and also societal attitude. But I would like to take us back to your earlier comments. You made a comment with regards to extremist groups and targeting these children. Why do you think out-of-school children are especially at risk of being targeted by extremist groups?
You see, like I was saying, education not only teaches literacy, but also critical thinking, resilience, and social skills that help children resist manipulation. So when children are out of school or excluded, they are more likely to suffer from idleness and economic desperation and social isolation. So extremist groups exploit this vulnerability by offering identity, belonging, and sometimes material incentives, things these children lack. So in places where the state is partly or completely absent, so extreme groups step in as providers of food, shelters, and purpose. So those out of school children become easy recruits in cycles of violence that further destabilize society.
That helps us understand the wider impact. But what about the children themselves? The way neglect shapes who they become? For that perspective, we have a child psychologist. Please introduce yourself, sir.
Hello, everyone. It's good to join this conversation. My name is Philip Dimka. I am a child psychologist. Thank you.
Tell us, what happens to a child's emotional and cognitive development when they grow up without education or supervision?
So, one of the key things that a child needs to develop properly is proper structure, proper context in, you know, structure. And that structure is provided in the context of one and supervision. And I define supervision as the presence of a consistent, you know, caregiver who is available to provide guidance, to model for the child as they grow. And education is another context that provides structure for the growth and development of a child. So these are two key factors that are needed for the child to develop appropriately. When education is lacking and supervision or the presence of a consistent and, you know, reflective caregiver is lacking in the life of the child, it impacts on the child emotionally, really, cognitively, and generally, I mean holistically. You know, when that child grows up, emotionally specifically, children need adults in their life in the context of primary caregivers, whether they are parents or in the absence of parents, a caregiver who is consistent, who provides, you know, reflection to the child's internal, you know, because the child is getting to learn about the world. So in the absence of that supervision, that presence, that education emotionally, it's evident that the child does not know how to develop their capacity to understand themselves and their own emotions and the emotions of others. Without that, the nervous system is dysregulated. The child, you know, does not have a model to model to them how to feel, how to manage emotions, how to express emotions. So they grow up as emotionally immature adults with just that inability to manage and contain their feelings. Sometimes because of all that happens without supervision, you know, their nervous system becomes overwhelmed. And most of those children will be observed to be impulsive children, aggressive children, you know, dysregulated children due to lack of socio-emotional skills. And over time, you know, it develops and forms, you know, it develops and crystallizes as a personality, you know, type for them, and it can impact them throughout life. But also, cognitively, lack of education and the presence of supervision can also impact cognitive development significantly. Because take education, for instance, is not just the knowledge and the learning that really takes place. One of the things education does for children is to provide structure, is to provide order, is to provide space for is to also provide community. So when that is lacking, there's sort of a poor development of the prefrontal cortex. That's the part of the brain that is in charge of learning, decision-making, thinking, problem-solving. So if the child does not have, and this does not, the prefrontal cortex does not just develop in the context of education alone, even in the context of supervision. And that's why both factors are interrelated. So the child will be poorly developed in their ability to think, in their ability to solve problems, in their ability to, you know, just carry out higher order life functions that help them cope and become, you know, good contributors to society in the future. So in my opinion, these are ways that they can be affected.
Thank you so much for that response. How does neglect shape their ability to contribute to society later in life?
Absolutely, in incredible ways. You see, neglect is, it's quiet, is an adverse experience that, you know, harms the brain and the nervous system and socio-emotional skills of children long-term. But the thing about neglect is quiet. It can go unnoticed. Neglect can either be, you know, physical, it can either be emotional neglect or, you know, even physical neglect or educational neglect, as the case may be. But it's one area that is quiet, but the impact is severe on the life of the child. This is because when a child is neglected, when they do not have supervision, they do not have constant, you know, supportive adults in their life, no structure in the home or in terms of education, then they lack the ability to develop key critical skills they need in life. Skills like, say, attunement to themselves and to others, you know. And that attunement can only come from, you know, the structure that and the guidance they receive, whether from educational, you know, context or at home, you know, in the context of supervision. So the neglect in itself says something to that child that has been neglected, that you're not worth noticing, you are not a priority, you are not important. So that child grows with that belief, and they go through life, you know, with the belief that they are not cared for, they are not important, they are not seen, they are not known. So they develop trust issues, you know, they struggle with building building healthy relationship with people, with adults in work, in school, or in the community. As a result, what do we see? They become loners, they struggle on their own. Most of them in adulthood cannot even keep a job because they are not employable, because they don't have the cognitive skills, they don't have the socio-emotional skills, they don't have the work ethics, they don't have the discipline. That's one reason why they cannot even contribute to society in later life. You know, so neglect does not just affect the individual, it affects the society at large in the long run.
From your professional view, what interventions actually work to reintegrate these children into education and society?
So, well, thinking about it, I would say before even interventions, one of the key primary things that a child that has been neglected, is out of school, does not have structure in the context of family or society, one of the key things they need is safety. They have learned that the world is not a safe place. I cannot trust anyone. I'm alone. No one cares about me. Lord, you know, nothing is working for me. So one of the key things before you can even help these children, you want to provide safety to them. You cannot provide education. You cannot provide intervention if a child is unsafe, if they cannot regulate, if they don't feel that they are cared for, they are loved. So that's one foundational thing that must be handled before you can even talk about interventions. So the long-term goal would be, how do we get these children to feel that they are accepted, they are loved, and that they can feel safe again? What can we provide to them? Is it reconnecting them to family? Is it finding safe homes for them where they can receive interventions and the structure they need? So one baseline, that baseline must be established. Interventions, and if we must give interventions, it must be twofold, in the form of relationships and then, you know, structured interventions. Relationships, because one thing every child needs to thrive, to become whole, to contribute meaningfully to society, is connection. And that connection must happen in the context of someone they can trust, whether a parent or a safe adult. So for children who don't have education or supervision, they lack that. So the first thing you want to do is to connect them to attuned adults, adults who will be consistent in their life. You know, talking about, it can be, I don't subscribe to orphanage. I prefer that if these children can be reconnected to family members where they can be in the context of family, that's the first level of intervention they need. But the second level will be a structured, you know, education like we're talking about. And it's not just any kind of education. Most of these children who've been neglected, they struggle in school. When they come back to school, no matter how good the school is, mostly they struggle, they perform poorly, because they've been exposed to adverse circumstances that has, you know, impacted on their brain and their nervous system, you know, reducing their ability to learn. So they want to be in a trauma-informed schools. And that's why today we're advocating for trauma-informed homes, trauma-informed communities, trauma-informed schools. So they need, even if they will get into a conventional school, the teachers, the adults need to be trained in trauma-informed practices to support the emotional, you know, the cognitive, the behavioral needs of these children, because they need over time to learn that I can trust this adult, I can trust this system. It is not like what I've known before, and that this system can support my needs. So, well, just to summarize on that, society has to believe and act, you know, as though these out-of-school children and these children that are roaming about without structure and education, we have to act as though they are human beings and they can be saved. And we have to begin to do all we can to contribute to providing safety and structure for these children. And that's only when formal interventions can work. And children like this will benefit highly from play therapy. Play therapy is a form of intervention designed to, you know, help children and adolescents who have gone through, you know, all kinds of adversity, from abuse to neglect, you know, to household dysfunctions, as the case may be. So they would benefit from play therapeutic interventions, whether in the form of school programs or in clinical settings where weekly they can be seen. And these interventions will help them rebuild their social, emotional skills, their cognitive skills, and bring healing in their lives. Yeah, well, generally just to say, I'm inspired by this conversation, and it really got me thinking about what we as a people, good as professionals, good as, you know, community stakeholders, are doing to support the need of people who are out of school. In my professional experience, you know, neglect impacts children severely into adulthood. In fact, it is so severe that they develop attachment issues even as adults. They become insecure, trust issues, you know, ability to form healthy relationships, ability to, you know, even have families. And even if they have families, they transfer that insecurity, you know, to their children, you know, leading to generational trauma. So I want to really re-echo again from a professional point of view that we must reevaluate how we are providing interventions and support for children who do not have them. Because if we do not do that, we are setting up these children for mental health issues in later life. We've noticed that children who experience neglect as childhood in childhood grow to become adults who suffer all kinds of mental health issues. There's a World Health statistics that reveals that more than up to 50% of mental health issues in later life has its onset by the age of 14. The question you and I should be asking is, what happens before the age of 14 that prepares an adult for a mental health breakdown in the future? So it means that adversity impacts a young brain significantly and changes it to break down in the future. But love, structure, safety would help a child to heal and regulate and prepare them to have a very stable life in the future. So that would be my closing thoughts.
Thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate you and your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We want to ask, what can be done? What solutions are already being tried? For that, we're joined by Mr. Muhammad Salbu Kiana, Executive Director of Almajiri Child Rights Initiative, an organization working directly on this crisis. Mr. Kiana, welcome to the crisis room.
Thank you, Salma, for having me. Good morning. Afternoon now, rather.
Thank you. Please tell us, what does your data show about the scale and urgency of this crisis?
Thank you very much once again for having me talk about this very important issue affecting our society and our country in particular. Unfortunately, Nigeria as a country is occupying this, is it not so enviable position as a country with the highest number of out-of-school children. And this position, we have been holding it for many years, as far as I know. From 2010 that we begin to talk about this issue, the figure of out-of-school children then was juggling between 7.5 to some say 9 million or 10 million. And the number rose from 10 or 9 million to 13.5 million in 2015. And currently, what we have been told by UNICEF and the World Bank, the number has risen up to 20 million out-of-school children. That is one in five of every out-of-school children globally. So the number is huge and is accelerating and increasing, and it's not nice for us as a country, and it's not nice for us as people. But and the number again differs and it varies within the country. In the northern part of the country, the number is even more with the situation of Almajiri, insecurity, girl child marriage, etc. So the number is huge and the urgency is just here as it's now. And if we must address this and save our future as a country, of course, the urgency cannot be overstated. Action must be taken right now and something must be done that is tangible to address it.
Thank you for that. That's such a high number, 1 out of 5. But again, what are some of the strategies that you have seen work? This could be strategies from governments, community initiatives, or international partners.
Unfortunately, the out-of-school crisis are multifaceted. They are a combination of multiple issues. And so there isn't like a silver bullet in a way. But of course, it has to be a combination of interventions and program. in different society, there might be certain strategies that can be adopted, and they have been adopted to bring children back to school. So the school feeding program is one, okay? There are research and evidence to show that this work, and this has increased enrollment, that is settling, is sure. So yes, school feeding programs are good strategies that have worked by the federal government, that is increasing enrollment and even retention. Also tying conditional cash transfer to enrollment of children has also reduced that dropout of children in many states. That has also been shown to work. I mean, just last week, I hosted the Education Outcome Fund. They are about enrolling like 62,000 out-of-school children in Lagos. Okay, it's a 5 years program and all of that. So organizations like that, the World Bank has like a 500 million education program to ensure children go back to school. There's the AJA program, Plan International doing a lot. So these are some of the strategies that have been implemented. And not also mentioned the out of school and Almadri Commission by the federal government. All of these are efforts that have been deployed to address the out-of-school crisis in Nigeria. But the question remains, are the numbers dropping or increasing? And I will say, unfortunately, the numbers are increasing. Why? Because these interventions are atomistic in nature. They seem to be addressing symptoms of the problem and not the root cause of the problem. And unfortunately, we cannot address the out-of-school children crisis with such atomistic intervention approach. So yes, these strategies have worked, but the question remains, are they really reducing the out-of-school children in Nigeria? And you will also agree with me that the answer is no.
While you were talking, I kept on thinking of most of the interventions that you mentioned. Yes, they're not looking at the root cause of the issue, which brings me to my next question. How much of this problem do you think is solvable with resources, and how much requires political will?
I wish also that money can really solve everything, you know. I mean, money is quite important and it could make a lot of difference. However, I think the political will is more important. And this is because there are many intersecting factors that contribute to the out-of-school crisis. The Almadri crisis that contribute to the Nigerian number of out-of-school crises requires real political will for it to be addressed. And there's no amount of commission, there's no amount of money that can be put into it. And it will solve if the political will to do the right thing is not there. Okay. Like I just mentioned to you, World Bank has like 500 million on the issue of education. Agile has many other million. Education Outcome Fund is bringing also like $25 million just in Lagos State. So the money seems to be there in a way. There's a UBEC fund that has not been assessed by state, you know. Definitely, I think the political will be the most challenging thing. Doing the right thing. Look at the education budget for Nigeria is very low against the recommended 25% by UNICEF by UNESCO. That's only the Enugu State government that has 30% of the budget to education. So that's first and huge. I know Sokoto State during Tambawal went to like 20%. But those are isolated cases, you know. But beyond that, the political will have not been very nice. And fortunately, it's really exacerbating the issues and crisis of out-of-school children in Nigeria.
Now, talking about political will, if you could recommend one urgent step Nigeria must take today, what would it be?
Increase access to education. Okay. By that, I mean making the education available in two ways. One, addressing issue of availability of the schools or the educational institutions for these children, and two, maintaining the existing infrastructure. So these are two silent drivers of out-of-school crisis in Nigeria that are hardly being talked about, okay? The political economy of aid is something that we don't plug more. We tend to tie the situation to just cultural, economic, and religious. Unfortunately, as human rights activists will tell you, these are just excuses that are used to justify abuse and exploitation of children, to justify this failure. The first reasons is failures of governance in making the school available and ensuring their functionality. So a lot of community don't have schools. Children are not going to school in those communities. Where there are even schools, the schools are dilapidated, no teachers don't come, and all of that. So if these two elements are not available, how do you address the issue of out-of-school children? Some parents told me these are some of the reasons they send their children to Almadiri school. There's no alternative in their community. Okay. So clearly, one urgent step is to improve access and make school available for a lot of children. And just before, I know this is the end, but it's important to mention it. If you look at India, India has a population of about 1.17 billion right now. But as far back as 1990, they have addressed their out-of-school crisis. How did they do it? They make sure that in every 3 kilometers in each community and villages, there is at least a primary school there. And in every 6 or 5 kilometers, there is a secondary school there. We have school deficit, and even where there are schools, they're either dilapidated and all of that. And that is increasing the number of out-of-school crises. And we're not talking about it as much as we should.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And yes, you're correct. That's the final question. Thank you for coming on today and for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you.
We've heard about the scale of Nigeria's lost children, millions out of classrooms, left to fend for themselves.
And the cost is staggering. Poverty that lasts generations, insecurity that feeds armed groups, and a weakened nation.
The truth is, solutions exist. They often begin close to home, in neighborhoods, local initiatives, and in people who refuse to give up on the next generation.
The education problem is also a national security problem, an economic problem, and a moral crisis.
How many futures can we afford to lose before we act? Every crisis has a story.
And every story deserves to be heard.
Thank you for sharing with us in the Crisis Room.
And before we go, what crisis are you paying attention to?